Hello, and welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency, devoted to promoting musicians and authors worldwide. Call us today at 941-877-1552 to start your free publicity evaluation. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Please welcome the host of Interviewing the Legends, music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello, once again, everyone. I'm your host, Ray Shasho. Welcome to another edition of Interviewing the Legends on VBS Radio, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552 or email us at thepublicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. And by The Rockstar Chronicles, my new book featuring over 45 intimate conversations with the greatest music legends the world will ever know, available now at bookbaby.com and amazon.com. As a founding member of the Jefferson Airplane and Hot Tuna, Jack Cassidy's full driving tone and innovative melodic bass work has defined the role of bass guitar in rock and roll for decades. Liberating the bass from its traditional role as part of the rhythm section, Jack's pioneering approach has brought the instrument to the forefront. With sweeping chords and stormy melodic lines, Jack's bass distinguished not only Jefferson Airplane and Hot Tuna, but also a variety of side projects and recordings with artists including Jimi Hendrix, David Crosby, Warren Zevon, Country Joe and the Fish, SVT, Rusted Root, and Government Mule. In September of 65, Cassidy received a fateful call from his old friend Jorma Kekkonen, which we just had on the show recently, who had transferred from Antioch College to Santa Clara University in San Francisco and became immersed and a new music scene developing there. As Jack recalls, Jorma told me he had joined a band called Jefferson Airplane, and I kind of laughed at the name. He asked me what I was doing and seemed surprised to hear that I was playing the bass. Then he says, "Wait a minute, I've got a bass player in this band that I'm not fond of. It's not working out, in my opinion." So then he says, "Let me call you back." A few minutes later, he calls back and says, "We got this band. We got a manager. And the manager promises to pay us $50 a week, whether we work or not." And I said, "You're on." When the original singer left the band to have a baby, it was Jack who convinced Grace Slick, and performing with her own band, The Great Society, to join the group. The roster complete, Jefferson Airplane rocketed to superstardom in 1967 on the initial strength of their hits, Somebody to Love and White Rabbit, making them a cornerstone of San Francisco's rock scene. Jack's groundbreaking bass work was a highlight of Surrealistic Pillow, the Airplane's 1967 breakthrough album. It was quite an eclectic album, and I think it still holds up today. The Jefferson Airplane was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1995. In 1970, Cassidy and Kekkonen found time between Airplane gigs to put together another uniquely named aggregation, the blues-influenced Hot Tuna. Hot Tuna shows are an opportunity to witness two lifelong friends coming together to make extraordinary music. "I can't remember having so much fun," says Cassidy, "but also musically being so in touch and in the moment with the music as I am now, where every minute, every note counts on stage. And I find it really unique that I have a situation with a partner of over 50 years now where we can just really enjoy the craft of making music together." Please welcome legendary American bass guitarist, best known as member of Jefferson Airplane and Hot Tuna and Rock and Roll Hall of Fame member, Jack Cassidy, to Interviewing the Legends. Hello, Jack.
Hello, how are you?
I'm doing good. Did I cover it all?
you read it pretty well.
Thanks. You had such a long, illustrious career. It's hard to get it all in, man.
Yeah, I got you on that one.
Well, me and you have something in common. I'm also from D.C.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, then I got to ask you, what neighborhood and what high school?
Well, I don't know. I went, you know, I was in the suburbs. I worked downtown in D.C. since I was 6 years old because my dad had an electronics store on F Street in D.C., Northwest. And I grew up actually kind of close to Danny Gatton in Southern Maryland.
That's great.
Yeah.
In Southern Maryland. Yeah. Southern Maryland, I guess.
In you know, the Waldorf White Plains area. That's where I lived quite a long time. Yep.
Yeah, I just went out there. I just finished a 5-week trip. I went out to Ohio, south of Athens, Ohio, to Yormish Kirk East Ranch Guitar Camp and Concert Hall. And I did, I went out there just the week before 4th of July. Because we were all, of course, supposed to be off touring in July, and that all went south with the COVID-19. So I decided you want to, 10 weeks before I had started with Vanessa Calkin and the Purpose Ranch quarantine series of concerts, webcasts that he did. So I thought I'd come out there and then we'd do one or two for real. So I stayed out there 3 weeks. We did the 4th of July, the 11th of July, and the 18th of July. And then but in between those last two, I went back out to the D.C. area, of course, and visited my cousin who lives down St. Leonard Barrel.
Oh, really?
Down from Annapolis on Route 4.
Uh-huh.
It's Prince George's County.
Yep.
So I got to eat some good Chesapeake Bay crab and visit the old haunts and drive by my old house at the neighborhood of Davenport and Reno Road that I grew up in and lived on.
Now, where did you live exactly? Did you live in D.C. or in Maryland?
I lived on Reno Road at Davenport, at Northwest D.C.
Oh, Northwest D.C., okay.
Yeah, it's just a block from Woodrow Wilson High School and Alice Steele Junior High and Ben W. Murch grade school that I went to. I never took a bus in my life.
Really?
Across the street from one block up to the other, two blocks up to the third.
Yeah. Well, you know, D.C. had a great music scene. Of course, the late Danny Gatton was a great player and very well loved in the D.C. area. And your buddy, right?
And my buddy, yeah. He was a year younger than I. And, of course, he was the wonder kid that, you know, was winning banjo and fiddle contests at age 12 and whatnot. But he settled in really heavily on the guitar and just had such a fluid style. Both left and right hand, using a variety of techniques, both with the pick and then the pick and the third finger to a pick, first finger, third finger, fourth finger to work his pick technique on his right hand. So he was really a master of the craft and could play so many genres and play it convincingly and well.
It's a shame you didn't get his...
And he loved hot rods, you know, so there you go.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, they called a lot of his music redneck jazz.
Well, you know, you get labeled that. Yeah, the people who do all the labeling, of course, are the people that write about it. And unfortunately, enough people didn't write about it early enough in his career. It was a tragic end to his career. He really should have gotten more attention. And of course, if he had somebody like we have Vanessa Calkin in our lives, you know, that paying attention to the nuts and bolts of your career would have been a different story for Danny.
Yeah, he was great, man. I loved a lot of his music, Funky Mama, Soul Sauce, Sleepwalk, you know, he did a lot of great tunes, and he was incredible. Other guys that should have made it really big, Roy Buchanan was another favorite of mine, you know, very big in the D.C. area.
Yeah, he came later. I never knew Roy very long. That was a little later in my scene. My scene was earlier.
Right.
I left in 1965, as you alluded to in the opening comments.
Right.
But you know, we all played in those days on the club circuit. We trade around to different bands. Another buddy of mine, Ronnie McDonald, was a singer and drummer. that played with Yoram and I in our little high school band when I was 14 and Yoram was 17. Warren Smith played drums as well. And we had the, you know, cover band doing Buddy Holly stuff and, a lot of simple rockabilly kind of music. But, nobody was encouraged to write their own stuff. And then once you got in the club scene, it was all about, you know, in a number of rhythm and blues bands in those days, you know, you had three saxes or two saxes and a trumpet, something like that. A Hammond organ. You did a lot of the rhythm and blues repertoire out of that, that era too.
You started playing in a band called the Triumphs in D.C.?
Well, that was the little band that Yoram and I formed together while I was in junior high school and he was in high school.
Wow.
That's the one I was just talking about.
Where did you go to high school?
Woodrow Wilson.
Oh, Woodrow Wilson. Yeah, that's big. Yeah, very famous. Very cool. Yeah, I went to a high school called Crossland in Temple Hills. I don't know if you knew that school or not.
I'm not aware of that.
Yeah.
It doesn't ring a bell.
On the outskirts. Yeah.
Right. What year was this you went to high school?
I graduated in 70.
So I'm graduated in 70, yeah.
A little younger than you.
62, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Just turned 61. You backed up Little Anthony in the Imperials as well, right?
Yeah, that was a job. I've met a number of musicians playing on different circuits. And one of the musicians that I played with that got me a number of jobs and into communities of playing that otherwise I wouldn't have found myself. With one of the drummers, many drummers that have played with James Brown. In those days I used to go down with my pal Ronnie McDonald and we'd go to the Howard Theater.
Yep.
On weekends and see just the tremendous, every act that came through the Howard, of course, went on up to New York and played the Apollo. So I saw all the great, bands, rhythm and blues bands and blues bands, Bobby Blue playing, Jackie Wilson, Ray Charles, and I even saw, Duke Ellington there. I saw, Ike and Tina Turner's first tours and Chuck Berry and all these wonderful acts of the late 50s.
Yeah, R&B is that circuit of, Baltimore, D.C., Philly. You know, we all had that R&B in our city. And I love R&B music and soul music as well. And I was very fortunate to have all the great music we grew up with, especially in D.C.,
Well, then you well know. I mean, it literally was. I would go, in the let's say around 1960. I would hear those kinds of acts at the Howard Theater.
Yeah.
Go over to the jazz clubs and hear Yusef Lateef and Eric Dolphy and Wes Montgomery playing with his brother Monk Montgomery on electric bass. And speaking of that, electric bass is very rare then. James Brown was one of the first players in the late 50s to use that bass. And it started out being pretty much mimicking what a stand-up bass would do. Don't forget all Ray Charles stuff was a stand-up bass.
That's right.
You know, and then it was used early in country bands. It's easy to carry around, but it was played more or less like you would play in the beginning, like you play a stand-up bass. Later on, it became to be appreciated that it had its unique character and abilities. Later on, much later on, with syncopation, we hear like Bootsy Collins or a number of guys that started to use a lot more syncopation that the guitar could do, the bass guitar could do, that the stand-up bass could. And it slowly started to develop its own repertoire and its own number of players that considered it a standalone instrument. You know, no longer the sort of convenient means of presenting bass work that was originally put together on a double bass.
Yeah, then when the electric bass came, then came the funk.
Well, that's what this has been saying. That syncopation that, you know, you were able to do on the instrument. If you listen to early James Brown stuff, the bass is mostly doing walking bass lines, like a conventional stand-up bass.
Right.
But James Brown, of course, went through a number of different musicians. When he went into later versions in the 70s, you know, then that funk sound started to come in with the syncopation, with the electric bass guitar. And that's really one of the huge major changes that happened in the sound of recorded music. And on the other side of the scale, you had players that were playing in electric bass in Motown and in Los Angeles that were approaching the bass in a recording studio, and the engineers, of course, had loved it because of the clarity and not only the syncopation you get with, but also the clarity and the attack you get with that electric bass was unique, and it started to develop its own sound.
But you started on guitar, right?
I started on guitar. Did you
originally play the stand-up bass, or you went right into the electric?
No, stand-up. First of all, you've got to think about it a minute. A stand-up bass is a violin.
Right.
Big violin. The whole other set of skill sets that you have to learn. It's a big violin. You get intonation in it. The frets not approached like a guitar at all. So I went from a guitar to a bass guitar, and that's how I approached it. I approached it as a low-end guitar.
Yeah, the stand-up bass looks like it's difficult to play. I don't know if it is or not.
Well, I mean, it's a violin.
Yeah.
Violin's a difficult instrument to play.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I got to talk about Jimi Hendrix, of course.
Go ahead.
I've interviewed a lot of guys that knew Jimi, and, you know, great guy, you know, always had his guitar with him, very chilled out kind of guy, I guess. You were on Electric Ladyland, and you were on Voodoo Child, right?
That's correct, the long version.
Yep. I had Mike Finnegan on the show recently, and he was also on that album. A lot of guys, I guess, were on that album. Talk about Jimi.
Well, I found him, and I've said this so many times.
Right.
He was really a sweet and serious individual. I met him soon after we played the Monterey Pop Festival together. You know, Jefferson Airplane and Jimi Hendrix and coming in his reinvention form from England with the Jimi Hendrix Experience. And, of course, the Who were on that bill.
Yep.
And Otis Redding and all those guys. And so I met him there, and as he was asked to play the Fillmore by my then-manager, Bill Graham, the airplane, we rehearsed next to where the Fillmore was almost like a house venue for us. We played it so much in the early years at San Francisco. So as the various bands would come through there, we got a chance to hang out, because we were still based in San Francisco. The bands liked to be in San Francisco. None of the bands had broken out to the extent where they could go on extensive major long tours and whatnot.
Right.
And so there was plenty of time to hang out while rehearsing. We were rehearsing relentlessly with the airplane for years, you know, every day, 5 days a week. But when the various people would come through the Fillmore to play and other venues in San Francisco, but primarily Fillmore, we really had a handle on access to all the musicians, and musicians love to meet each other and hang out, do what musicians do, you know. So we, Jimi and I, and Mitch Mitchell particularly, had reached a friendship and shared bills together. And so when he was doing this album a few years later on, and he had just gotten control of the studio situation and producing it on his own, he had a much, you know, more time to experiment in the studio. And one of his experiments was while Traffic was in town in New York playing at Steve Paul's Scene, Jefferson Airplane was in town. We were doing a TV show, Dick Cavett, I believe. And then we met at Steve Fall's scene. Jimmy was coming in for the studio, took a break, and saw his old buddies Traffic that he knew from England. We all met there and invited us back to the studio. Yuam and I back to the studio. We went back with about, I don't know, 15 other people. Some of the guys from Traffic too. And then, we watched them work and do some overdubs and takes, and at about, you know, about 6:30 in the morning, he said, let's do a blues. So I was there and we set up shop and very quickly, and went over the song, and he had a good idea of how he wanted to set the song out. We went over it about halfway through, and I think he broke a string, and then we did a complete version. Then it was about 7:30 in the morning. We jumped in our station wagon, drove down to D.C. because we had to kick the next day.
Oh, wow.
So we had a great time doing it. He was a very generous musician.
Yeah.
You know, he's not, he wasn't authoritative, in this. Everybody, we got to take the song to really, an interesting level and work in different areas. It was, you know, we looked at each other in the eyes, and there was no barriers, shall I say. We all just looked at each other and played and kept eye contact and played through the song. And then about a month later, I got a phone call from him. I gave him all my phone information he had, of course. Got a phone call in the office in San Francisco where we rehearsed. And he said, do you mind if I put this on the album? I said, fine. I said, what are you, crazy? It's 15 minutes long. But that's what we were starting to do. We were breaking away from the confines of our contracts and what had been done before with recording records. And he ended up with all the material I had, putting out a double album, you know. And one of the cuts on the album took up a whole side, which was this cut. So
That's great. You know, one of the best songs ever, you know, as well. And one of the best albums, Electric Ladyland. No doubt.
Yeah, it's fantastic. It's really, really good. We listen to the album so much.
it's timeless, too. You know, you can listen to Hendrix anytime, man. It's like, you know, it never gets old. It really doesn't.
Yeah.
You know, Wikipedia says, and it says the same thing about Mike Finnegan, that you were actually played live with Jimmy. Is that true?
Like
on stage.
Mike Finnegan?
Like on stage. Did you ever play on stage with Jimmy?
Yeah, of course.
Oh,
yeah.
You did?
There's a couple of albums out. We were playing Red House and a couple other numbers. Well, that was a great thing. Once we recorded together, then when he was at Winterland and when he played Oakland Coliseum, you know, and I was in town,
right,
not on the road, then I went out to see him and he invited me on stage to play. And we had a hook then. You know, we had a song to play, plus a couple other songs, and it was great. It was absolutely great.
I was very fortunate to chat with Paul Kattner, before he passed away. A great guy, man. I had a great talk with him. He was a lot of fun.
Absolutely.
He was talking about Woodstock, that he was on stage and couldn't get up because he was so stoned. And
no, we. That's not true.
That's
we were not so stoned we could not get off stage.
No. I think he was just sitting on the stage. I don't know if he was. He wasn't performing. He was just sitting on the stage somewhere.
And yeah, he, right.
Yeah.
No, of course, we were there for almost 2 days before we.
Right, came. Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, great guy. We one of the funny things he said was, he said one of the highlights in his career was getting mentioned as one of the devil's acolytes on the Jim and Tammy Baker show. And he actually went over their house, to Jim and Tammy Baker's house in North Carolina, and he said he actually stole some chord changes from Tammy Faye Baker's band. I thought that was pretty
there
funny.
You go. There you go. That's Paul for you.
Is that Paul?
Paul.
And, you know, he was telling me, he was really chilled. He went to a place called Cafe Trista, and that was his little hangout.
It's called Cafe Trieste in San Francisco. As a matter of fact, I'm looking right now at 5 pounds of espresso beans that I ordered about every 4 weeks or so of Cafe Trias Espresso Bean that I've set down here in Los Angeles.
Must be a great place.
The good coffee.
Yeah. He said his you know, he loved science fiction, he says, and he'd go in there, read a book, and that was his life. He really enjoyed that.
Yeah, he did.
Yep. And we talked about Altamont, of course. What was your impression of that show?
Well, you know, Altamont was a, you know, a cluster. So it's been talked to death. But, you know, it was just it was a good example of what not to do when you're putting a concert together into a variety of, you know, I don't blame anybody or anything for it. But it was a good example of when things go wrong and what to look out for in the future. So we went there, we played the best we could, and we got out of there.
Right, right. Did anybody approach you or, you know, like the Hell's Angels or anybody? Did you have any issues?
No.
No. Yeah. And what I understand, the guy that rushed the stage, he had a gun, right?
You know, you'll have to get your confirmation from somebody else.
Okay. That's what I understood. The guy rushed the stage and the Hell's Angel guy had to stop him. So I think that's what happened anyway. I want to talk about Dream Factor. I love the album, okay. By the way. That's a great album.
Well, thank you very kindly. I appreciate that. You're one of the few that's heard it.
it's like it's been hiding, man. Why isn't it out there? It's you know.
I don't know either.
I gave it 5 stars. That's how good I thought it was.
Well, as a follow-up, I'm now working on an album. Actually, I finished it.
Uh-huh.
I'm working on all the artwork and whatnot. I've got, for the last 3 years, I've recorded 19 songs. I finished the last tracks just before COVID-19 shut everything down.
Right.
In February, I did the last recording here in Los Angeles at my studio. And then Yoram and I went out for a 3-week tour. I came back March 2nd, and of course that following weekend everything shut down. So the good news is, I'm putting that together. I recorded it both here and in Jersey, Channel Islands, where I have another home with a recording studio there. So I had a number of people come out that I played with, about 15 years ago. I played with Yair Delal at one of the Womad festivals. We just struck up a great friendship. He plays oud and violin. He's an Israel musician.
Oh, cool.
Musician from Israel. And we did a number of songs together there, things that I've wrote. And also I wanted to work with a musician called Daniel Maison, electronic musician from France. So we did that work there. There's another, musician prominently on the album, Isaiah Gage, who plays cello, and then there's just a number of different approaches we did on the album. I used my acoustic bass guitar a lot.
Oh, cool.
Diana.
Yeah.
Acoustic bass guitar made by Tom Rebecki. And it's a very, I think you'll like it, it's a very interesting album. I use first tone sound on it a lot. I use acoustic bass guitar sound. A lot of melody work, a lot of solo work, and a lot of ensemble work. So, but there are no vocals. It's all instrumental, mm-hmm. And I think it's going to be great. So, that's what we're working on. Finishing that up now. So very soon I'll have something to put out there to you.
Excellent, excellent.
So you keep in touch with with Cash.
Yep.
All right.
Just yep.
Put this together, and when we're ready to release that, which I hope will be within a month or two, then we can do a. You can listen to it and see what you think.
Oh yeah, we'll get you back on the show, and we'll talk about that album as well. But, you know, Dream Factor was such a surprise. I mean, you have Jim Brunberg. Brunberg, he was, what a voice on that guy, huh? Very soulful.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And you have some great players on there. You got Greg Hampton. Greg Hampton, the one saw Listen to the Wind, which yeah. one of my favorites. Sounded very Lynyrd Skynyrd, huh?
Yeah, very nice. You know, it was a fun album. That particular album was from the approach of playing with a lot of different singers and
right.
songwriters and guys. And I did a portion of the songwriting on guitar, and then I would hand the music to various lyricists that would work with the tunes. So I wanted it to be a tune-oriented album, and I thought it came out really successful. And I recorded that all here in my studio here in Los Angeles.
I'm going to promote the hell out of it. I think it's great. You know, I really do.
And well, go right ahead.
It should be out there, man.
Better late than never.
I mean, you got Fee Waybill on Sweden. You know, we had Fee on the show. Great guy.
He's a great guy.
Yeah, he nailed it.
You know.
He really nailed it.
I knew his drummer really well, Prairie Prince.
And, yep, Prairie Prince, another guy, good guy. Yep. Weight of Sin. These are my favorites. Weight of Sin. Who Are You? Which was a rocker. Dead Letter
right.
Box. Blues tune. Great keyboards on that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, very excellent album, man. Outside, jazzy and funky. You know, very cool track as well. I loved it. Can you talk to me about, let's see, what was the song I wanted you to, shoot? Daddy's Little Girl.
Yeah, actually, my producer, Stacy Parrish, wrote the lyrics on that one.
Okay.
And Ivan sang it. And I did the music.
Right.
So that's kind of how that came about to be. It was just a fun song to do, you know. And it, lyric wise, that's what Stacey had written at the time. So
right.
I put all the changes together as music first, and then he put the words to that, and then we had Ivan come in and sing it. Of course, Ivan Neville's just a monster, you know.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I was really proud to have him play.
And you have, is it Paul Barrere? Is that how you pronounce him?
Yeah.
He passed away recently, which is a shame. He was a.
I absolutely. And, yeah. You know, he's such a sweet guy. All those guys with that organization were.
Yeah. Little Feet.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, it's a good album. It should be more, you know, publicized, you know, and I don't know why it's not. That's all I got to say about that.
Okay, well, thank you.
It's a great album. 5 stars all the way for that album. I'm really looking forward to the next album as well.
Alrighty.
Yeah. The what was the last time you talked to Grace Slick?
Let's see. That's 7 days ago.
Oh, really? That's cool. How's she doing?
She's doing great. And of course, like everybody else, you know, she's a painter. She had exhibitions that she was supposed to show up at,
right.
and all of that, and all that had to be canceled. So all of us that deal with in person all artists that deal with groups of people in front of them have been put behind the eight ball on this COVID-19 issue. So we were more or less lamenting about how long it's going to take before things are back to normal. We came to the conclusion we don't think it's going to be anytime soon, that's for sure.
I know. Isn't that a shame? I mean, they were talking about, you know, drive-through concerts, you know, where you can drive up and just sit in your car and watch
a
concert.
Well, and also the other one I saw was a vertical concert where everybody books a hotel room with a balcony and you play down below.
How will the acoustics be for that?
I don't know. I haven't done it yet.
You know, we're going to miss Hot Tuna because you guys had a tour plan. You know, I love Hot Tuna, but, you know, America's Choice is probably... I got to be honest. I love the Electric Hot Tuna.
Right. Hey. All right. You know, And so we try to mix it up. I mean, I think in these days we play a little more acoustic just because of the access to more venues, and that, and there's so many more places now where we can play acoustic and have it really an intimate, very clear, dynamic show with the kind of interplay that we do that can now be heard with the present day, development of sound systems and sound reinforcement. But we've in the last few years we've really been cranking up our electric stuff too, and like I say, we were supposed to be out all of July all electric.
Yeah.
So now we don't know what's going to happen, and we're just kind of waiting. So now it's virtual. I'll be going back to, driving now. I'll be driving back out because I'm not going to fly. I'm going to be driving back out to Ohio, so okay. That's 5 days of driving out. And then I'm going to teach out there in October and November, where the whole year has been canceled, you know, for teaching. And now Vanessa at the Herpes Ranch has set up the teaching where the plexiglass in between the students and the proper distancing and fewer students than I would normally teach at a time, probably about five at a time. And we'll do another virtual YouTube show, like we did, in July.
Yeah, I've been watching those. I admire you guys for teaching. You know, that's incredible. I mean,
Johan has always been a teacher his whole life. He's never not taught.
Right.
I taught a little bit, you know, in the back of a music store when I was in those years, mm-hmm. when I was in D.C. And then Johan invited me to be a teacher at his Herpes Ranch Guitar Camp when it opened up almost 24 years ago. And then I really had to put together a good program for that. So that's what I'll be doing then. And you always have been teaching, Zoom teaching classes.
Right.
And I'm about to start up mine as well.
Yeah. I talked to Lee Oscar. He's doing the harmonica thing online too, which is cool. Yeah. What was I going to say? I just lost it there for a minute. My first guitar, I bought at Chuck Levin's. Yes. Remember Chuck Levin's?
Oh, fantastic, yeah.
Yeah.
That's where I got my Chuck Levin's. I got a number of instruments there.
Uh-huh.
I got, 1958, there's a picture of Yorm and I playing out there, I'll send you. I'm playing a 58 Telecaster, of course, $115 in 1958.
Wow.
And I wish I had that guitar today. But, in 1960, I bought a brand new, the first year, when I was talking about that story of playing bass and playing with Danny Gatton, he's the one that got me into playing bass.
Mm-hmm.
Did I tell you that story?
I don't think so.
No. Okay. In 1960, Danny had a summer gig lined up at the various clubs, and we both played 15 years old in the D.C. club scene, even though we were supposed to be in there until you were 18. They both had fake IDs to say that we were 18. In any case, he had a band together and a full gig lined up. And of course, the gigs in those days, in those clubs, like the Dixie Pig or Ranch, Benny's mm-hmm. or Hayloft, you played four or five sets a night, and you played Sunday afternoons, and six nights a week, So, he had a good gig lined up, and I think it paid all of $150 a week, which was a lot of money back then. And, his bass player got very ill that summer, and so Danny called me. I said, do you know a bass player can fill in? And there weren't very many bass players, like I said before.
Mm-hmm.
Bass guitarist.
Right.
And, he had played, he was playing at the time the new Precision, which was Sunburst with a sculpted back, in 1960. So, to make a long story short, Danny said, asked me, he says, listen, I can't find anybody. Why don't you do the gig? It's good money. I said, listen, I've never played the bass guitar. And that's where the famous line came up. How hard can it be? It's only got four strings. So anyway, we've used that every year since. But in any case, I borrowed the gentleman's bass.
Right.
And I played the gig, and I don't know whether it was 2 weeks or a month or something, but playing it every night. By the end of it, I thought, you know, I really like this instrument. I really like the tonal aspect. And it started to get into when you get the power and the position of that a bass player has in a band. So I went and bought a new, but the bass was kind of, let me put it back in a minute, the bass was a little big for my hands, the precision. So I had read that Fender had just come out that year with the jazz bass, which had a more narrow nut at the top. And it had two pickups, and I figured that had more tonal variations on it. So I bought the jazz bass that year, which was a lot of money. I think it was $280 or something. And then I started playing, you know, I was playing bass and bass guitar, but my work quota exponentially zoomed up because then I was playing a lot of bands, from country bands and the country fair circuits in the summertime, and the Circle Line that went between Marshall Hall and
Marshall Hall, D.C.
Yeah. Marshall Hall, you could gamble, play the slots over there, and, you know, it was like a carnival type situation. And did a lot of club work, you know, both playing guitar and bass guitar.
You remember the gambling in Waldorf? They had the Stardust, and they had a lot of gambling was legal back then in the early 60s.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, in Southern Maryland. Yeah.
Yeah, Southern Maryland. That's where everybody went.
Yeah, the Stardust had a lot of great groups came to the Stardust back in the
day. Yeah, and also, you know, also we played places like the Dixie Pig all the time.
Right, right.
Which was, and that's where Charlie Daniels got to start there. And that, you know, a lot of musicians.
And of course, you know, we were.
And there were some tough clubs too.
Yeah, of course, we were famous for the Cellar Door. You know,
but that was later.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah. But, I really admired the Cellar Door and what they did. With concert promoting, it was incredible, you know?
Yeah, well, they made it a cornerstone at GCC there.
So. They sure did. Here's a question, Jack, I ask everybody, and I get some really interesting answers about this. and you've been around so many great players. If you had a Field of Dreams wish to play, perform, or collaborate with anyone from the past or present, who would that be?
And I don't think I have a good answer, you know, because I haven't really thought about it that way. You know, you always would love to see how you would fit in with various players. You know, I think of course I think it would always be fun and great to play with an Eric Clapton or something like that. But you know, there's. You know, it's more like I would love to have heard people, got the chance to hear people in person, like Jelly Roll Morton or you know, Amos Milburn, some of the great piano players. Get their chance to play with Ray Charles, you know, or something like that. You know, that kind of really would intrigue me. I think, you know, to be able to see how I could insert myself and learn from those kind of cats, you know.
Yeah, exactly. What about the great jazz players? I mean, you'd fit right in on bass.
Well, you know, I figure I could do a little work, but you know, when you're talking about an Eric Dolphin or an Ornette Coleman or something, they're just so far advanced in their harmonic and melodic concepts, you know, I'd love to be in the room with them and be honored to let me noodle around with it, but mostly I'd love to see what I could learn right away from him, you know.
I had John McLaughlin on recently. I think you'd fit in well, you know, as a member.
Absolutely, yeah. They're a great guy. They're a great player.
Great, great, great player. Well, Jack, I think that's all I got. You got the new album coming out. When do you think it'll be released?
Well, I'm going to have to release it myself. So we're putting the nuts and bolts together with that now. So I would say, I certainly hope it's before the end of the year.
Well, I'll promote the hell out of it for you, because...
Well, thank you very kindly. I appreciate that.
And also Dream Factory, which I gave it 5 stars. It's one of those albums, people got to find, I'm going to put it out there, because it's a great album. Great players on that album.
I'd appreciate that.
And you got a video out, too, called the Bass Guitar of Jack Cassidy, right? A DVD?
Yes, I've got that out, and there's a... There's hopefully some future stuff on the way in the teaching category as well.
Okay, awesome. Jack, it's been great talking to you, man. Great to talk with a fellow Washingtonian.
Yep, absolutely.
Can't wait till you guys are back on the road again with Hot Tuna, man. And I'm sure you'll be coming back to Florida as well.
I certainly hope so.
All right, Jack. Take care, man. Stay safe.
Okay, thanks a lot.
All right,
I appreciate it.
Bye-bye. Purchase the most recent release by Jack Cassidy entitled Dream Factor at Amazon.com. It is a 5-star review. It is a great album. Also, the bass guitar of Jack Cassidy, Learning How to Play Bass. It's on DVD. Jack Cassidy shares his ideas and techniques with learning bassists. In an informal and delightful session, Yarmer provides vocals and guitar along with companionable commentary. Jack analyzes his bass parts for classic tunes from the Hot Tuna repertoire and discusses the musical concepts that make up his unique style. Melodic lines, tonal variety, chordal work, and improvisational solos. You'll see all of Jack's tricks, the use of partial chords, sustained notes, tremolos, trilling, tonal variety, and many other fascinating devices. Songs include 99 Years Blues, Blues in A, San Francisco Bay Blues, Been So Long, Man's Fate, and Water Song, all available at Amazon.com. For more information about Jack Cassidy and Hot Tuna, you can visit www.jackcassidy.com or his partner of over 50 years, www.yormakokonen.com, and, of course, www.hottuna.com. Jack's also on Facebook, www.facebook.com/jack.cassidy. Yorma's Fur Piece Ranch YouTube channel. Visit that. The Fur Piece YouTube channel has over 3 million views. And many renowned artists from live concerts are featured at the Fur Piece station. Very special thanks to Cash Edwards Music Services for arranging this interview with Jack Cassidy and the dynamic duo of Doug and Don Newsome of BBS Radio for making magic happen for each and every broadcast of Interviewing the Legends. If you have comments or suggestions for the show, contact me at interviewingthelegends@gmail.com. And please subscribe to my YouTube channel, Interviewing the Legends with Ray Shasho, for the very latest interviews. It's real news, people. And, of course, my new book is finally out, entitled The Rockstar Chronicles, Series 1. Chronicles truths, confessions, and wisdom from the music legends that set us free. You can order yours today on hardcover, collector's hardcover edition, or ebook at bookbaby.com, featuring over 45 intimate conversations with some of the greatest rock legends the world will ever know. Stay safe, everybody, and have a great week. Bye-bye now.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to Interviewing the Legends, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Tune in to Interviewing the Legends every Tuesday at 7 p.m. Pacific Time on BBS Radio, Station 1.